Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Peter, and I'm an alcoholic. I am also a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I am the adult child of an alcoholic, and I am married to an alcoholic, and I spend a lot of time with sponsees and other alcoholics who are not always in the best health, so Al-Anon has been very good for me in that regard. And if you are a male on my dad's side of the family, as far as I know, you are an alcoholic, so they're around me everywhere. So thanks to Shelley for asking me to speak tonight. You got my better half last night. My wife spoke last night, and she is better looking, smarter, and a better speaker. So I'll just put that out there right now, because I've heard her speak, and she's very good. Gifts of recovery. You know, my alcoholic brain quickly went to what me coming up with some original idea about what the gifts of recovery are. And I think one of my favorite gifts of being an AA and Al-Anon is I have not had to have a single original thought or idea to stop drinking and to have a better life. And that's hard for a guy that liked to think he knew everything or had to know everything and had to share what he knew with everybody, because I could enlighten you. And if you would just do things the way I thought or told you, then I would be happy and have a good life. And, you know, I did a lot of drinking over that. I did a lot of worrying over that type of thinking. But when I finally got on my knees and said the words, "I need help," there was instantly pressure that was removed. So, you know, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Blue Book, that book was written for a guy like me that couldn't stop drinking and couldn't stop lying. I believe it was divinely inspired somehow. And the answers are all in there. So what I thought I'd talk about today are the promises in AA, because the book tells me what the gifts of recovery are. And so I thought I'd just go through those quickly and relate what they mean to me. So, and there's 12 of them. We like our 12s in recovery. So there's actually, the trick question is, there's actually more than 12 promises in the Big Book, but there's 12 famous promises in the Big Book. The first is, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. And this is talking about being halfway through step 9, but the promises start with an if statement and end with an if statement, and they're all about doing the work. For me to be painstaking in step 9, I have to be painstaking in doing the first 8 steps. And these steps have been an absolute gift in my life. Not drinking and stopping lying was a really good thing, but that didn't change how I lived. The steps have changed how I've lived. They've had impacts on my family, on my employer, on my friends, in ways that I just could have never imagined. So I've had to do the work, and it turns out I can't do the work. I don't have the strength on my own to do that work. I need a higher power and these fellowships to give me the courage and the strength to do things I never thought that I could do. The second promise is we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Freedom from the bondage of myself and from alcohol. I was either drinking or spent every minute awake thinking about the next drunk. I was a binge drinker. I never got to the point of daily drinking. I'm sure I was well on my way to that. But the reality is, when I wasn't drinking, all I was thinking about was when the next binge was going to be and getting to that point in time. And, you know, the freedom from self, the freedom from not having to lie. To drink the way I wanted to drink, I had to lie a lot. And actually, dishonesty is what brought me to my knees and got me to these rooms. So I'm really grateful I don't have to live that way anymore. The third promise, and goes to the workshop that was just talked about, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And this takes me right to walking out of the first step 5 I did and just having this sense that, you know, that really was me. I really did all those things. I had all those behaviors, and I'm responsible for all that stuff. But I'm going to be okay. Like, it can be okay. I can learn from that. It doesn't have to drive my thinking and my fears and my guilt and my shame anymore. And I can move forward and become something different. I really don't want to be that person anymore. Because I tell you, at the end, it was guilt, shame, regret of the past and inexplainable fear of the future, never in the present. The fourth promise, we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. And, you know, my definition of serenity before I got to these rooms would have been that you're happy all the time. And that's not my definition today. My definition is a sense that things are going to be okay. If I am right with my higher power and myself, regardless of what's going on, there can be really crappy things going on because life is life and I get to live in reality today. That's another gift of recovery. Or things can be going really well. I can just have a sense that things are going to be okay. When I don't have that sense, there's something that I need to look inside myself and find and deal with. Promise number five, no matter how far down the scale we've gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. This is all that crap I was never going to say. I was going to the grave with. This was never going to come out with a sponsor or in a step five, or this is 30 years of lying and hiding terrible things to be able to drink. And, you know, who would have ever thought that I can freely talk about these things today and that might help other people? You know, people in recovery, talking to people in recovery is how we get healthier. And I never know what you might relate to in my story. And I don't know what you guys are going to say that I'm going to relate to. I just know every time I'm in a meeting or one-on-one with another alcoholic or person in Al-Anon, it happens. It happens every time. And so it's a gift to be able to share that stuff. And, you know, the first time I spit those things out, it was with a box of Kleenex and couldn't believe I was saying them out loud. And today they're just part of my story. You know, so it's that's been a cool transition. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Loved self-pity, right? Because that could drive my behaviors to get people to recognize me and pat me on the back. And I still dabble in those things. So those are things that is in step 10. It talks about upon awakening, things to look out for. Those are a couple things for me to look out for and watch for, because they're like a comfortable old glove for me. I can put them back on. In a heartbeat. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-centeredness, self-seeking, moving away. I actually believe what God's will is for me. Everybody has their own belief on that, is to be of service to my higher power and to others with the right motives. I did a lot of nice things when I was drinking, but there was always a catch. There was something I was looking for in return. In these rooms, I've learned that it's just the healthy thing to do is to do the right things because you feel better, not because you need attention or something back. And what I've been given back is just a sober, amazing life. The eighth promise is very similar to me. Self-seeking will slip away. More and more, my goals are not about me. When I get into trouble, my goals are about me. So there's a dynamic there. That's a big part of my step 10 each night with my higher power is, how have I behaved and what have my motives been? Were they about me or were they about being a good person? How did my higher power and I do today? And that's the conversation I have in the mirror each night. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. I didn't think the way I think today. I didn't look forward to getting up each morning. I went to bed telling myself what a loser I was and that tomorrow I would be a different person. And then each morning, when the water in the shower hit me, I'd shrug my shoulders and just, crap, it's not going to be today. I'm going to drink again today. I'm going to be in fear again today. And I'm going to think about killing myself again today. That's what it was like for me at the end. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. For the greatest part, fear has left me. Anxiety happens. It's normal emotion. Things come up. More often than not, I just do whatever the next thing is to do. Fear comes back, and it's all self-centered based. It's me moving away from my higher power and thinking I know what's going to happen and then wanting to control and change what's about to happen. And fear comes back instantly. And I've done that in recovery. My last step five I did on my 5.5 years in sobriety. And every time I got into trouble in recovery, I've moved away from my higher power and fear comes back. Because it's me running the show for what Peter wants, not what Peter needs. 11, this is my favorite promise. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. Everything baffled me at the end. I could not make a single decision about anything. And if I did make a decision, the instant I made it, I double-guessed it and thought it was wrong and wondered what people thought about it today. You know, I'm a dad and a husband and an employee. And a friend. I got hundreds, if not thousands, of decisions to make each day. Most of them are really simple things that normal people do every day. There's things I have to do to be able to, getting up, making my bed, eating breakfast, going to work, being a good employee, coming home, cooking supper, spending time with family, going to sleep. Like my sponsor would always talk about that. And then you repeat. But what I've added in is prayer in the morning, checking in with my higher power in the fellowship during the day or a meeting, and then thanking God at night before I go to bed. That was the thing I didn't, so if I don't do those things, I skip all the stuff I'm supposed to do at some point, and then I get into real trouble. And the last promise is we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And one of the favorite things I've ever heard in recovery, Bob P. at his 35th birthday said, when he was one time asked, how did he know God or his higher power was who helped him to stop drinking? He said, he's the only one he asked. And that's true of me. Until I got on my knees and said the words, I need help, nothing changed. And nothing was going to change. I can't explain what happened after I said those words and said that prayer, other than God, higher power, entity, whatever you want to call it, has done for me what I could not do for myself. Then it ends with, are these extravagant promises? We think not. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. So I've had these promises. I don't just get to keep them, right? I have to continue to do the work. And that's steps 10, 11, and 12. That's revisiting the steps on a regular basis. That's doing, I wish the 5.5 years of sobriety I have, I wish every day was cumulative and it gave me a buffer for the rest of my life. It just doesn't. I stopped going to meetings for a week. It's over real fast for me. Like things get bad really fast. So it's just, my life is 4 or 5 AA meetings and an Al-Anon meeting every week. It's just what it has to be. So, and I just wanted to end with, this is a much lesser known promise, but I think it's just absolutely, there's actually a step 10 promise in the big book. And if you're a person that wants to stop drinking, this is just the most beautiful thing in my mind. So I'll just read this. And if we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor that has been giving us without any thought or effort on our part, it just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor afraid. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. So it promises me if I do these simple things, alcohol's not an issue. That power alcohol had over me will be removed. And that has been true for me. Tonight, if you want to talk about gifts of recovery, my wife and I will go out to Pine Lodge and each share our stories with 24 addicts and alcoholics. Our family was destroyed 5.5 years ago and apart for almost 1.5 years. So we are a family under one roof again. And we have our struggles and trials in recovery, but we're a miracle. We're an absolute miracle, and that is a gift. So I thank you for inviting me to share today a little bit of my story, and hope you have a great rest of the festival.
Thank you, Peter. Great job. Next up, we have Brian from Prince Albert.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian from Prince Albert, a grateful member of Al-Anon. Oh, so where to begin? My gifts of recovery is really accepting what step one has done for me. It's basically freed me up to become a functioning human being. So where to begin? For me, step one was admitting where I came from. So I was a product of a step 13, to be honest. So I was born into resenting the product. I was born resenting the program to begin with, because it was a long time before we started to view the program as a positive thing again. And I want to see what brought me to Al-Anon in the first place. What brought me to Al-Anon traditionally was not the traditional reasons. I came here trying to fix my depression. My depression was activated at about 7 years old after I suffered sexual abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, emotional abuse, every kind of abuse tree that you can come up with. And my bipolar disorder, before you could even call it bipolar disorder, was activated, and it was made to be the worst possible scenario for me. I lost the will to live at a very young age. And I remember going to snowbanks and everything in the middle of 40 below weather, falling asleep in snow patches even before I knew that was a suicide attempt. And that was my earliest recollections of basically knowing that I didn't want to be on the earth anymore. That was straight up what I was trying to do on this world. I was trying to escape it. I was always trying to escape the will to live. I did not want to be here anymore. And I was always trying to escape the expectations of Christmas time, the alcohol abuse. I don't know, the abuse of Christmas time, the abuse of just life beating me up on a day-to-day basis. So let's go back a little bit. I was born basically an only child, and that's to be described as I was an only child. I do have 5 half siblings. I have 3 step siblings that later came into my life around 6 to 7 years old, but I was raised as an only child. My step siblings lived in Regina on my stepfather's side, and my half siblings were on my father's side, who was the step 13er. And basically, I never got to know them. It was a resentment-filled marriage. They never got married, but it was resentment filled from the very beginning. My father suffered alcohol abuse, he suffered drug abuse, and he had a heart attack at 40. So I lost him at 8 years old, and I only hung out with him maybe 3 to 6 times in my entire life. And I never had that father figure. My stepfather did the best he could, but if you couldn't relate to him in sports, you couldn't relate to him in anything. So I related to him in sports later in life. If we can talk Carolina Panthers and Minnesota Vikings, that's our relationship. And that is our relationship today, still as we talk. And he does the best he can, but he's a product of an alcoholic home too. And I never was unwilling to accept alcoholism as a disease for the longest period of time. I'm 31 years old today, and we'll get into why that number is significant a little bit in the future. When it comes to my depression, let's start basically where it became an issue. I lived a very transient lifestyle. I grew up in low-income families, and nothing against low-income families, but when you grow up in that sort of culture, there's always alcohol abuse, there's always drug abuse, there's always those sort of things around in the neighborhood that make you highly susceptible to being victimized. And I was victimized. And I don't want to be the token adult child that blames everything on their parents and doesn't blame everything on their neighborhood or their circumstances. But I had to look in the past to be able to move to the future, to be able to make a conscious decision that I don't want to live there forever. I have to be able to look at that, heal from it, move on to the future as an adult, not use those childhood coping mechanisms, and continue to move on. So let's start with school, shall we? Kindergarten, I went to St. Anne's. Grade 1, I went to St. Anne's. Grade 2, I went to Vincent Massey. Grade 3, I went to St. John's. Grade 4, I went to Vincent Massey. Grade 5, I went to Vincent Massey, Holliston, Lester B. Pearson, Queen Elizabeth. Grade 6, I went to Queen Elizabeth. Grade 7, I went to Clavette. Grade 8, I went to Queen Elizabeth. These are different schools in different cities, by the way, too. So when I say them, they're different. Like I said, transient. Grade 9, I'm missing some of them, by the way. Aiden Bowman, Nutana, Collegiate, Marion Graham, Walter Murray. Nope, never went to Walter Murray. Grade 10, Pacey, Carlton. Grade 11, I did a bunch of homeschooling. Went back to Ian and Bowman for a little while. And then that's when I phased out of school. The school system failed me. I failed the school system. My greatest memories of high school were me saying I had enough of life. I had a crowd here, and there's another crowd here. We competed with each other, and it ended with me dropping my arms saying, just take it all your frustration out of me. Don't take it out on these guys. So I got the two front teeth of mine knocked out, and I have crowns basically put in here. And it's a constant reminder every 10 to 20 years that I have to go back to the dentist and get new crowns put in every 10 to 20 years, that I decided to be a victim rather than just mind my own business and not be in my own hula hoop, as we like to say in Al-Anon once in a while. But that's the only way I knew how to find value. I wanted to be, at that time, Jesus-like. And I warped it. Because my concept of being Jesus-like was, my God was judging and condemning. And for me, I had to take on the hurts and the frustrations of the world. So that also didn't help my depression. So imagine that. And by me taking it on that way, I took on those hurts and those frustrations, and I put it on me in the physical ways that I understood. I was in fights, never threw the first punch ever, but I was in fights uncountable amount of times, 50 of them maybe. And I'm surprised I don't have more scars or beat up in different ways. I know I'm talking pretty fast and I'm jumping around a lot, but that's, I'm not going to tell my whole story. I'm just going to talk about where the depression is coming from and how it continued to develop. And this is where it comes for me. I always played the victim, and I always played the escape role. And I always played taking on everybody's hurts and their frustrations, because I planned to leave the earth by 30. That was my plan. If life didn't get significantly better and God didn't show himself, like literally come down and say, I am God and here's my plan for you, and life didn't get significantly better and my purpose didn't come into fruition, then I was going to leave this earth by 30. So what has the gift of recovery done to me? Well, step one was me going to the psychiatrist. And it took him 3 years to get me to go to Al-Anon. Every single time I would see him once a month, exhausting the medical model. Every prescription on demand, SSRIs, all that sort of thing that might go over some people's heads. So I'm not going to go over the list of the medications, but experimental ones, ones that are not even covered by the drug plan. Everything to try and balance out your brain. It all failed. And you know why it failed? Because my brain wasn't responding to any sort of treatments, because I've already designated myself as being the victim. It failed because I decided that it wasn't good. I was going to fail on medications no matter what. The chemical imbalance was not going to correct itself no matter what. So it didn't. So I tried behavioral therapies. I tried dialectical behavioral therapies. I tried all the other basically fancy terms where you sit down with a counselor or you sit down with a psychiatrist and they analyze you and they go through your thought patterns and they root you out and they make you put your thoughts down on paper and they analyze it and they tell you where it came from and you break it down and it's very scientifical and it should correct it, and it never did. Why didn't it fix itself? Because I had decided I was going to be a victim. And I decided it wasn't going to work before it ever got started. But I always wanted to survive. Just that was deep down in my essence, in my subconscious, that I decided I wanted to survive. It was never in my conscience. So what did I try next? I tried the extreme treatments. I tried shock therapy. I tried TMS treatments. TMS is the new lighter treatment where they put a cap on you and they shock you while you're still awake. And then shock treatments is not what you think it is anymore, but it's still they put you under and they make sure you don't bite your tongue off and they still shock you. And you go through those treatments. And did that work for a time? It worked for about a month before my brain reset itself to automatically saying, nope, not going to work anymore. No more happiness for Brian. And all of this was tried with balancing medications and behavioral therapies and all that sort of thing that fixed my depression. And all this was me not accepting alcoholism as a disease, by the way. So what was the next step? This new experimental treatment called DBS. And if you don't know what DBS is, it's called deep brain stimulation treatment. They do it on Parkinson's patients, by the way. It's where they drill a dime-sized hole in the back of your head. They put in a chip on basically somewhere near your temporal lobe. They put a pacemaker in your shoulder and you shock yourself every time you feel sad. So that works really well on Parkinson's patients, but they're doing it on people that have extreme major depressive disorder for their whole life, which I've had. And when you do that, basically it works, by the way, but the extreme amount that you have to do that, you have to keep shocking yourself every time you feel sad. And what did I do? He said, you can sign up for the waiting list for that, or you can go to Al-Anon. So what did I choose? I said, put me on the waiting list for the DBS. But by the way, I will try Al-Anon in the meantime since it's a year or two waiting list. So I went to Al-Anon, my first meeting. And I'm not going to tell my mom's story, but basically my psychiatrist and I have been working together for probably about 5 or 6 years on this whole depression thing. And he brought my mom into the office and he asked her, so is there any addiction problems in your family whatsoever? And she said, no, maybe on his dad's side. And the reason why that's funny is because I'm the son of an alcoholic. I'm the grandson of an alcoholic. I'm the great-grandson of an alcoholic. I'm the great-great-grandson of an alcoholic. I'm the great-great-great-grandson of an alcoholic. On both sides, by the way. My half-siblings have alcoholic problems. My nephews are alcoholics. They're all drug addicts, too, by the way. I don't even have to bring up their drug addiction problems, but they're all alcoholics. Definitely qualify to be here on the direct terms of what the Al-Anon declarations basically state, where this is why you qualify to become a member of Al-Anon. So step one for me, though, how can I qualify for Al-Anon? How could alcohol actually affect me as a person? I'm not an alcoholic. I can drink. I never drank until I was 19 on my birthday. But why didn't I never drink until I was 19 on my birthday? Maybe it's because everybody around me completely screwed up their life every time they touched a drink. Maybe it's because I had a lot of fear towards alcohol. And it wasn't until I was 19 that I touched my first drink. So step one for me in my recovery was going to a lot of meetings. It was opening myself up to the idea of service. Guess what I did? My group needed a group rep and I asked, what does a group rep do? They told me what a group rep does and they said, do you want to be group rep? And I'm like, sure. So only a few weeks later I asked, how long do you have to be a group rep for? And they said, 3 years. I'm like, really? Okay. A few months later I asked, okay, I went to district meetings. They said they needed an alternate district rep. What does an alternate district rep do? This is what an alternate district rep does. Okay, I'll be an alternate district rep. A few months later, our district rep stepped down. So now I'm the district rep. And I'm 2 years into the program, and apparently you have to be 3 years as a full group rep term before you can even be a district rep. So we're paving new ground in Prince Albert, which is completely okay. So what's my gift to recovery? I treated Al-Anon like a full-time job. That's what got me healthy. So Mondays, 8 o'clock, Tuesdays, 6:30. I started that adult child group in PA. Wednesdays, 8 o'clock, Thursdays, noon, Thursdays, 8 o'clock, Fridays, 6:30, open AA meeting, Saturdays, 11 o'clock, Sundays. I'm probably going to open up a Sunday group because we don't have anything. So that's what Al-Anon means to me, and that's my gift of recovery was step one, just accepting that alcoholism affected my life. Finally, I went to Al-Anon. And by the way, that group was about to fold if I would have never stepped in. I brought myself to that meeting and two other family members. And ever since then, we've been going consistently, me and my two family members. And since then, I brought two other family members. One has faded away because she's healed. But I can't work her program or her hair inventory. And that's completely okay. But the gift of recovery and the fixing to key to my depression, but guess what? Medications work now for the first time in my life. And my primary purpose to come in Al-Anon to fix my depression, but it's just accepting step one that my life was unmanageable. And I'm 31 years old today. I made it past the keystone of 30. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. You're not the only district that has group reps that become alternate district reps and then the district rep in less than 3 years. I just keep coming back and keep being involved in service. So our final speaker for our panel was living in Regina and going to the adult child meeting here, and she has recently moved to North Battleford. So please help me welcome Luda.
I have to set everything up. So, hi, my name is Luda. And I have to do the bad language warning. Not in terms of bad words, but it's just bad English. And a heavy accent. So I want to start to speak about my journey to recovery. I'm ways to go yet, but I started. I'm a formal group rep in one of the groups here. Wasn't doing very good, from my opinion, but they said I'm okay. I'm an adult child of alcoholic. My parents are adult children of alcoholics, and I don't know how far down in my family. So I grew up in dysfunctional family. There were lots of fights. My mom fights with my dad. Myself, I fight with my mom. Myself and my sister. My dad beat up his father. So lots of blame, lots of resentment, not much of love. They did love me, but they just didn't know how to show it. Because nobody know how to speak honest, nobody know how to open feelings. And then I'm not mad at my parents for doing that. It just, they didn't know any better. So I felt like something's going on, something is wrong there. I wanted to get out of that family. I just couldn't stand those fights every day. So I went to different city to study. We fight with my mom over the phone. So that didn't really help. And when I come back home after a weekend, my mom would bring up all the stuff that she had over a week. And we discuss that and fight again. So I learned how to run again. And I had the opportunity to go to Denmark for, it's like school practice, but it was really work. So I went there just to try to run away again. And what I was really missing over my life is that love, that warmth, that feelings. I wanted to be loved. And I told my parents many times, you don't love me. They're like, oh, we bind you everything? Don't you see that? Like, that's not exactly what I wanted. So I had relationships in Denmark with a guy from Ukrainian guy, and it wasn't healthy relationship. I just was desperate for love, and I would do anything for that. And of course, I got betrayed, and I had lots of resentment. And I become vengeful. Because I didn't know how to deal with that pain, right? So I started relationship just to venge with different person, and I become pregnant. And Denmark, being a student, being by myself, being having parents who would want me to be a good girl, and I didn't know how to tell them about it. So I did an abortion there, and that's when I start hating myself. I thought I'm not a good person anymore. I don't deserve anything good. And whatever, like, nothing matters anymore. I failed. And I was like 20. So I came back. I ran from Denmark again. I came back to Ukraine, and I continue living in hatred. So I become a love addict, for lack of better word. I just was looking for that love, for that care, even for a minute, just to numb the pain, just to feel good for a moment. Because I felt worthless, I felt like I don't deserve any better relationship. So, and when I meet good guys in my life, I ran from them. I got annoyed. How can you treat me so good? I don't deserve it. So the worse guy I met, the better. The worse he treated me, the better. I remember coming back home and just crying in the bathtub. Just, I didn't feel good about myself. I just was punishing myself. Then I had an opportunity to go to Canada. I actually married the guy who I did not have a child with. I married, and he offered me to come to Canada. And I thought, I'm not gonna get anything better. I don't love him, but I don't deserve any love. So, and I wanted to start over. I wanted normal life like my parents think I should have. So I didn't know what was wrong, right? So I tried to live the way I learned from my parents. So, and I didn't love the person, so I just ran from him again. I lived in Saskatoon. I ran to small town in Canada, or in Saskatchewan, to it's a Kipling. I stayed there. I was looking for the person who will love me, and it's didn't happen because I didn't know how to be loved. I didn't love myself. How can somebody else love me? So I ran from there. I ran to Regina, and I met a person who was suffering too, who had his own problems, his own addictions, and I fell in love with his pain. I felt like if we can help each other, we can heal each other, I can save him, and we can live good forever. It's ever and ever. But it just doesn't work. It never could work, because it's not my job to fix that person. So at some point in this not so healthy relationships, numerous time in my life, I just felt like I can't do it anymore. If this person can't love me, who can? And I'm tired. I'm tired of looking for that care, that love that I never had. And I when he threatened to leave me, I tried to kill myself. I just, because I didn't see the point. And then I went to counselor and psychiatrist, and they referred me to Al-Anon. The changes didn't happen instantly, but I found a place where there was no judgment. I've been in recovery for 2.5 years so far, and I began healing. I start seeing myself better. I forgived myself for what I've done. And I ended up my dysfunctional relationships because he wasn't ready to change yet, and it's not my job. I finally realized that. I did not accept any more unfair, disrespectful, dishonest attitude to me. That's what was normal in my family of origin. Al-Anon and other healthcare workers inspired me to go to the psychiatric nursing program when I can bring this message to others in need. And as been said, I moved to North Battleford for school. And yesterday I came here and I cried my eyes out all evening. I haven't been to Al-Anon meetings since I moved, and it's been not so long, just a month. But that's when I needed these meetings the most, because of the, I start worry, I start being afraid, I start being anxious, depressed, because it's new surroundings, new controlling people around me. Lots of work need to be done. So, and the most thing, I start working with people who are not healthy mentally, and they have many issues, and alcoholism one of those. And I started to, I was trying to fix them. I was trying to control them. And this is back to start again. So I would come home very drained up, tired, emotionally exhausted. I didn't have energy to go to meeting. That's how I excuse myself from going. And yesterday, when I sit here, I realized that there are so many gifts that I'm missing from not going to the group meetings. I felt relieved. I felt like I'm at home, and I felt the warmth and honesty of people who are speaking here, who were here hugging me and just smiling. I felt like I'm accepted, just like I am. So, but to enjoy those gifts, I have to be here. I have to use it. So, I will bring examples of the gifts, since I was asked. The honor to speak here, and the honor to be for a short time a group rep, made me feel like I'm part of a big thing. I develop self-efficacy. I develop belief that I can do it. I am worthy. I am not worse than others. My sponsor, she been my reliable support for all the hard times. And I know there is no, we cannot give advices and everything, she doesn't do it, but if she could, if it was okay to give a kick in the butt, she would do it many times. Okay. And Al-Anon spirit in the room, that's my other gift. It gives me serenity. It brings me back to the earth. Especially when something happens in my life and all the old habits come up again, and I can come here, share my feelings, listen, and think about that there are good things in life, not just my new catastrophe. I remember I went to the meeting, I felt like I'm high on life. Just because, I was by myself, I didn't have anyone like in my life that time, but I was so happy. So that's what Al-Anon gives me. And I'm not afraid of being myself. And not afraid of being not accepted by others. And I can wear the bright clothes that maybe not everyone would like. But it just make me feel good about myself. And I can do what I wanna do. Just because it makes me love myself. And Al-Anon teach me self-love and self-care, as I said, by doing what I want to do, not someone else want me to do. And I developed belief in Al-Anon, that people we met in our lives, in our life journey, are not just alcoholics, addicts, psychos. There are just good people, exhausted, ruined by diseases. And we don't have to hate them or judge them. All we can do is to express empathy and protect ourselves from this disease. And by saying that, we just need to keep coming back. Thank you.